so saith a thousand tedious memes. Indeed, automating as much as possible brings advantages of efficiency, but it's a culture shift as well. Today, join the Data Knots as we climb aboard our orbiting data center platform and explore the outer reaches of automation. Okay, you know, maybe outer reaches is an exaggeration, but at least we're going to get some solid introduction to this whole automation thing. Joining me today is my illustrious Mr. How many titles have I given you, Ethan? Quite a few. Ethan Banks, how are you doing today, sir?
What you told me before the show was I need to eat a Snickers. So I think Diva was the next title you were looking for.
I'm going to go with the Grouchy Grump because I like alliteration.
But there you go. I'll take
it. We will derail from the Grouch because you've had your Snickers. So
I have.
Are you doing snazzy today, sir?
Doing snazzy. And you, coming off the road?
Oh, yeah. A lot of travel. What I'm very excited about today, it's like I get to come home and do a recording with a automation guru. So we should introduce our guests. Rob Nelson, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. That is quite a promise to live up to, guru there.
Give us the short pitch. You know, introduce yourself. Who are you? You know, who is your daddy and what does he do?
I've been in IT for almost 20 years now, done a number of jobs and basically do system and infrastructure administration with a focus on automation.
Fair enough. You can tell you're talking to a quality engineer because they talk about themselves with like one sentence. It's like, yep, I'm an engineer. I do things. Let's move on. Let's talk technical.
We make things work and we make people happy.
Your bailiwick is Puppet, from what I could tell, digging in through your blog and some of the presentations you've done, Rob, right?
Certainly. I've spent a lot of time over the past 2 years neck deep in Puppet, and it's a lot of fun, a lot of new things to learn, and a lot of great things to show off as well.
Man, neck deep in Puppet. For some, I think that would be like a dream job, and for others, I can almost hear them shaking like, oh no, I would not want to be having to do that all day. First question I have before we kind of go into automation a little deeper is, when did you start with automation? You know, when was this something you're like, yes, I would like to do this?
I think all of us use automation a little bit here and there, but it really became a focus probably within the last 5 or 6 years. You get to the point where you're tired of add a user to Active Directory, right? Click copy and put some stuff in and then open the user when you're done and fill in a few forms. You get tired of that pretty quickly in your IT life. So you hit a point where you're just like, well, I don't want to do that anymore. And how can I not do that and still provide the same level of service to my end users? I think when you hit that point, that's when automation starts to make sense.
So basically the plot to the movie Office Space.
Pretty much.
So I guess I'll kick things off. Let's kind of level set on what we're talking about here with automation. In the context of a data center, what are we referring to when we talk about automation? And I'd like to contrast automation when we cover that away from orchestration, because when I hear marketing folks saying automation, it's always coupled with orchestration and they kind of form a run-on sentence with the two. So what do we mean by automation and how does it differ from orchestration?
So the first part is going back to what automation was, not just in the data center, but it actually was a term that really wasn't in our lexicon prior to 1947. General Motors created an automation department. And what they were trying to do was adopt to industrial control systems that provided some feedback. They'd have some sort of target they wanted to hit and a controller that would try and maintain it, much like cruise control in your car or the thermostat in your house. You want to drive 55 miles an hour, so the car speeds up or slows down until you get right around 55 miles an hour. So that's where automation as a term comes from. Obviously, we use the same kind of thing in a data center. It's the same context. You know, if you're working in the physical controls like temperature and humidity, it really is the exact same thing. You got a thermostat, you keep the humidity at a certain level, but we also can use it to refer to the services that we're providing. Someone opens a ticket online, an email is fired off, an approval process begins, or a group needs a web server, so they go to the portal, select the size they want, click order, and a few minutes later they get some sort of notification saying the web server's ready. And all of the underneath part of that is driven by automation.
It sounds like we're taking something that you could do manually in some way, shape, or form and finding a way to trigger that using software. Is it any kind of specific software? I know we talked Puppet, or is there a specific method, or just automation is we're not having to do it manually anymore?
We're not having to do it manually anymore. We're putting a control system around it. And that control system could be, as you mentioned, a shell script or a PowerShell. It could be some sort of more complex tool, Puppet. Could be a purpose-bought utility for it.
So is orchestration really then just a whole bunch of different automated steps working together? To me, they almost sound one and the same.
the big difference between automation and orchestration is automation is the control system. Orchestration is how you trigger different things in the automation. So an orchestration engine might say, when we hit this utilization, we need to kick off our automation script that spins up a new web server or spins it down if the utilization gets too low. So orchestration is kind of like the conductor in an orchestra. He's controlling the automation.
Kind of reminds me of like the control plane of a network device versus the data plane. You know, one is kind of deciding what to do. The other one's kind of doing it.
Yeah.
So Rob, does automation have anything to do with DevOps? I've come from a networking background where there's been a lot of talk about DevOps and understanding those processes. And some people have even chosen the term NetOps. I don't know that that's a great term, but would you say automation ties into DevOps in any way?
Absolutely. DevOps itself is a somewhat nebulous term. Everybody's got a slightly different definition, and it typically has to do with culture rather than specific tools. But it is important that you have tools that provide automation. You mentioned the network space. If you use Juniper devices, you might have Juniper Space, or if you're Cisco, you might have CSM. Those are automation. It's just providing those kinds of tools to automate different things that used to be done by humans and try and get the humans out of the system and let the system itself take care of it. That's definitely vital to DevOps. No matter what definition you use, it really is part of it.
Again, DevOps being as much cultural as it is a specific thing.
Yes.
It seems like every day we shift the definition on DevOps around. And on one hand, I see positions posted on all those other tech sites for DevOps engineer. And so that makes me think, oh, it's a skill set. You know, it's something you have to know. And then other places, everyone's saying, no, that's horrible. It's culture shift. It's, you know, it's a condition of our operations. It's a way to get things done. And so I don't know. It just feels like no one fully agrees on the term yet. It's still a little nebulous. I think you bring up a good point with let's do automation. Okay, that makes sense. At a high level, I am a sysadmin or a network admin or whatever I am. What tasks should I focus on automating? You know, what are things worth spending time to automate?
The easy answer is everything.
Everything.
You really want to do want to automate all the things. But what you want to look at first are either the high volume tasks, the one that you're doing every day, creating new users, resetting passwords, or those lower volume tasks that are more complicated and maybe you don't do very frequently. And those are really a great candidate for your early automation, because if it's something you do on like a quarterly or even yearly basis, you may have done it 6 times already if you've been with the company a long time. But that 7th time you do it, the 7th year, you're reinventing or remembering what you did before and your memory may not be great. So if you have the automation that does it for you, you just go click a button.
It's like a new version of blog posts. That's why I typically write blog posts, or at least when I started, was to not forget what I did. And so this is like blog 2.0. It's like WordPress.awesome. You just make a script or an automation task out of it, and that's how you remember, you know, kind of what you were doing.
Well, it's not just the memory of what you're doing. It's also the time that's saved. I saw a tweet today that said, I don't have time to automate my tasks, which I thought was hilarious.
That's like a catch-22, right?
Exactly. Well, that's the whole joke. If you don't have time to automate your tasks, the only thing you have time to do is automate some of this stuff.
Yeah, well, you got to kind of make the decision. Do you want to be a firefighter, or do you want to be Smokey the Bear preventing forest fires?
The ladies out there seem to like the firefighters a little more than Smokey the Bear. I think that translates to the fact that a lot of places I work with, you just get more recognition as a firefighter. I don't necessarily think I ever wanted to be one, and I certainly tried to go down this path of automating, but there is kind of a sexiness to the guy or girl that can just swoop in and solve the problem. It's like improperly rewarded for being very reactive instead of proactive.
Much is often said about the hero or rock star culture that some companies cultivate, and there's certainly space for it. But I think it behooves everybody at the company to have automation in place so your rock stars get some sleep.
Yeah.
Because really what it comes down to is the rock stars, the firefighters, the heroes are always busy. They're always doing something. If you've read Phoenix Project, Brent is a really tired person. You know, you got to give Brent a break.
Yeah. Basically, Brent was the, you know, like super ninja guru guy at the fictitious company in the book. And Brent was fixing stuff. No one even knew what he was doing. So it was all tribal knowledge. And great book, though. It's worth reading. Let's shift a little bit. Let me put on my cynical hat, which looks like a cactus. And I'm going to say what I typically hear out there in the world of sysadmins and such. I'm not a developer. I don't care about scripting. You know, I've used the UI and the GUI forever, and it works just fine. And I hear all these products that are going for this whole, I'm invisible, I self-configure myself. So it's kind of like, okay, things have been okay for years. They seem to just be automating themselves. Why should I care to invest in automation, either as a skill set or just something to do?
Yeah, there's a lot of great answers to this, and we could probably have a four-hour long talk just on this part. But a few highlights is, from a skill standpoint, if you want to be working in IT in 10 years, you absolutely are going to need to spend some time getting some level of interest and knowledge in automation. Maybe you don't have to be the person at your company for automation, but you need to be able to work with it. You need to understand it, and you need to not be flustered by it. Or maybe you will still be working for the company, but you'll just be collecting a paycheck and sitting in the corner. Going back to our office space analogy, somebody will be stealing your red stapler. Nobody quite wants to be there. But there are other reasons that are great too. The DevOps report that Gene Kim and some other people work on every year has shown that companies that adopt a lot of what we're going to talk about with automation and configuration management are anywhere from 30 to like 100 and sometimes more efficient, more agile, higher performing than companies that don't.
Okay, so it's not even a matter of I'm getting things done. You're saying if I adopt automation, even if I'm totally cynical about everything else, I'm not only going to get it done, I'm going to get it done more efficiently or maybe less risk prone because I have an automation engine that's doing it and it never is wrong unless I wrote the thing wrong. Just has more benefits beyond just getting the job done.
Correct. I think Mr. Snover of PowerShell fame likes to say, I'm a deeply flawed individual and the computer is not.
Now, Rob, you mentioned configuration management a minute ago. How does that fit into this whole world of automation and DevOps?
So configuration management is a subset of automation, and it's very closely tied to DevOps from a perspective. We talked about it's mostly culture rather than tools, but you hear it come into the conversation a lot with DevOps. And configuration management is just what it says. It's an automation system that focuses on managing the configuration of systems. It could be servers, it could be routers and firewalls. And we've probably all played with some form of configuration management utilities before, even if they weren't called configuration management. I mentioned CSM or Juniper Space. Those are configuration management tools for firewalls and routers and switches.
Okay, so one last question on this level setting that we're discussing here. Let's talk about some tools that are common in the automation world. And I'll give you some that I've heard of, and you can kind of fill in the blanks here. Maybe as we talk about them, you could describe target market. Who is this tool aimed at? Chef, Puppet, Salt, and Ansible for starters. If I'm a Chef user, why am I using it? What's it doing for me? Who am I?
So Chef and Puppet together are kind of the granddaddies of the modern configuration management tools. They're both written in Ruby. Puppet's been around a little longer since 2005, Chef since 2009. But these tools both have a great wealth of users, shared knowledge. They're using Ruby. That's kind of a commonality between them. They've got a lot of other differences, but those are some of the similarities.
They are distinct tools, correct? You almost always hear them in tandem, but
they are distinct tools. And once in a while, you'll see some people go back and forth between them. But the two companies have a great relationship and there's no war there. They're great tools. They each have their own purposes, but you can work with either one and be really happy. They're both very mature.
Is there a simple way you could distinguish between the two? Like you say, they both have distinct purposes. Is there an easy way you can delineate between when I might use Chef and when Puppet might be better?
Chef is an imperative model and Puppet is a declarative model. That's one primary difference between them. There's some other differences in architecture and usage that some people find a little better for their work environment. Puppet tends to have a master and agents check in, and Chef uses a slightly different system. Neither one is better than the other. There's two different fits for different organizations.
Sounds like multiple ways to slice bread. And in some cases, it depends on, you know, what brand of slicer you like. Whereas you look at someone using Chef, you know, the end of their workflows, someone using Puppet, the end of their workflows, and you're like, huh, same kind of stuff's getting done. It's just they prefer Apple over Android as an example.
How does Salt fit into the mix?
So then the next two, Salt and Ansible, kind of come in together. It seems like these configuration management tools come in pairs. And Salt and Ansible, they're both relatively new compared to Chef and Puppet, and they're written in Python. So that's another big difference between those. The other two are written in Ruby. Salt and Ansible are in Python. And if you look out there, you'll find some people that are kind of divided. Other people, it's just a tool. But, you know, if you're looking at your company and what you might have to do, maybe that makes more sense to go with a tool that's written in a language that your team members know.
I know from a networking standpoint, Ansible has gotten some traction because it's agentless. There are modules people have written to do the arbitration between the Ansible playbook and then what actually needs to happen on the network device to fulfill that. And that's been helpful. Puppet, on the other hand, as you mentioned earlier, requires an agent, which there's not tons of support for that in the networking world at this point. There is some, but not a lot.
Correct. And in Ansible, you just need SSH or PowerShell. And it also has an orchestration engine built into it. We talked about that a little before, where you can say, I want to do something now, and it goes to do it, and it uses whatever automation engine. And sometimes these things are complementary. Some people use Puppet or Chef for their config management of their systems, but then they use the orchestration engine of Ansible to kick off Puppet and Chef.
Yeah, I'll add, Jason Edelman has been really rocking it out there on the Ansible space, especially with various Cisco and Juniper stuff. So definitely like jedelman.com, his blog has a lot of great goodies if you're an Ansible or networking person. The one thing that we didn't cover so far, you know, I'm kind of a PowerShell nerd, is the desired state config, DSC. Rob, are you seeing people using this, or is it kind of early days still, and kind of what's your thoughts on that particular configuration management tool?
Yeah, where I'm at, it's still a little early days at my company, and part of that has to do with DSC is kind of new, and it requires newer versions of PowerShell, but it also is maybe coming into the fold where people aren't necessarily seeing it, but it's there because Puppet now uses PowerShell DSC for managing Windows systems. I'm not certain what level, but I think Chef, Salt, and Ansible can all support it as well. So some people may be using it and not even realize it.
It's like a tool using a tool. I guess that begs one last question that I had was, are you supposed to just pick one, or is it more common to use multiple of these tools?
I think most companies, most individuals are probably going to pick one. But depending on your workflow, depending on how large your engineering or software development team is, it might make more sense to go for two. If you've got 100 nodes, the orchestration engine is nice to have, but it may not be everything you need, so you're going to go spend all your time on it. But if you've got 10,000 nodes, then you probably want the orchestration engine. That's where it seems like you see more companies and groups that say, I've got 1,000 nodes, 10,000 nodes, and they're using a combination of tools to get the desired effect. It really comes down to the team you have as well. You know, if you've got people that have Ruby and Python experience, maybe you choose two tools, one from each camp. If you've only got some experience with Ruby or only with Python, you stick with what you know.
Wow, configuration management sounds interesting. There's a lot of new terms. There's a lot of different tools. It's a little bit of DevOps and automation. I'll tell you, Ethan, the big takeaway I had for this first discussion around level setting is go after those common tasks with your automation efforts. You know, you have a limited and finite amount of time available. Everybody knows that. So go after whatever the low-hanging fruit is with the biggest impact, or pick something that in my mind has a lot of risk associated with it, meaning I'm a human, I make errors, maybe this is a very common configuration that is somewhat error prone, so go ahead and automate that away to eliminate some of that risk. Where's your head at, Ethan?
Yeah, and so by risk, you don't mean we should tackle the biggest servers in the data center that have the most traffic. You mean, you know, there's a lot of risk that some human's going to screw it up. So let's see if we can automate this. Yeah, I get where you're coming from.
Yeah, like the I got rid of a user and then I have to go delete all their stuff. And oops, I deleted the wrong user's stuff.
But the biggest takeaway for me was the distinction between orchestration and simple automation. A lot of times you read blogs and you hear vendor marketing literature and stuff, and they don't make it easy to understand what the difference is between the two, if they even know it themselves. Depending on who's doing the writing, they may not have a clear distinction. But I think Rob made it pretty clear to me when he said orchestration is the conductor that makes the automation happen. That kind of sunk in with me. So you've got a threshold that triggers the orchestration system that then calls an automation event to happen. And I liked that analogy. That was very helpful to me. Well, Rob, now that we've done some level setting on automation, orchestration, some of the tools that can be used, configuration management, let's dive into one of your specialties, which is automation with Puppet. So why did you pick Puppet and not a different tool to specialize in?
It's a great question. There's a lot of good reasons to choose Puppet, but I'll admit for me, it was kind of haphazard. It was a flip of a coin between Chef and Puppet when I started working on it, and I choose Puppet. But it's been the right choice for me. As I mentioned, there's the Ruby tools and the Python tools. I know a lot of people love Python, but I grew up in the age of curly braces, and Python does not work for me. It messes with my mind with all that blank space. Ruby makes sense to me. So that was definitely a reason to stick with it. And the Puppet community itself is pretty awesome. There's a ton of help out there. Plenty of people have written hundreds, thousands of blog posts. There's a very active Twitter and IRC community, a lot of shared code. VMware has also invested in Puppet Labs. So you'll see Puppet Labs at VMworld, at VMUGs. They've also got a bare metal tool called Razor that you can use to provision your ESXi infrastructure, and tons of vCenter modules.
I love that you've answered a question that I see 2,000 word blog posts on, meaning folks are like, which one do you pick? And they go down to all the little nitty gritties, checkboxes, and you're like, flipped a coin. Yeah, that's all I needed. That's awesome.
Rob, how important was the Ruby aspect of it for you, though? Because, I understand the tool is written in Ruby, but do you really have to spend that much time in the code that Ruby versus Python would be a decision point?
You don't necessarily need to. It really depends on your level of desire to work on the tool, I guess. For me, it may not work for everybody, but I enjoy contributing to open source projects, and I'd love to be able to jump in and take a look. And if I run into a bug, I can at least find it, even if I can't fix it. But there are some tools where you can take Ruby ERB templates, which is just a fancy way of saying you can have a little template file for config and then pass some parameters in. And to write that, you need to have a basic understanding of Ruby. You don't need to be advanced. You don't even really need to be able to write your own Ruby program. You just need to be able to look at some Ruby syntax and understand what it's saying and maybe change a few lines here and there.
That makes sense. Yeah, I've spent some time with Python. I have no Ruby background at all. I can get around Python just fine. So it's interesting you put it that way. That might point me in an Ansible direction since I already have some Python background.
Yeah, and I probably could get around Python. Well, I just, like I said, the blank space in Python just messes with me.
No, and I like that you also brought up one other, probably low on your priority list, I would assume, but was that you wanted to contribute back to the code base. And since there's such a huge community element to automation and config management and writing these various bits of code to automate things, that kind of makes sense with me.
Yeah, and they have hackathons, triage-a-thons, so that anybody can contribute. You can help out with fixing documentation if you care to, or you can dive all the way into the deep end and fix some, you know, real core infrastructure components of Puppet if that's what you want to do. Or you can just kind of hang out and watch what other people are doing and kind of learn through osmosis, because one of the big things for me when I was learning this, the first triage-a-thon I attended, I didn't know much about Puppet at all. But I learned a lot of bugs that people had run into, and how things were worked around, and better ways to do things. You know, sometimes the response on a ticket was, don't do it that way, do it this other way. And if I had tried to do that on my own, it would be like 3 or 4 years of experience before I picked that stuff up. Just looking at what other people had done, to me, is a great way to learn.
Yeah, definitely. That's why I think things like paired programming is so valuable, because you gain the 10, 20 years of experience that your mentor has acquired, and then they kind of lay it on you like peanut butter, which could be quite helpful. I'd like to go a little deeper into Puppet. You know, for those who have never touched it, never played with it, what are the kind of different flavors of Puppet available to deploy within an environment?
So there's two main flavors. There's Puppet open source, and that's free for everybody. You can go out, you can do whatever you want with it, take the parts that you want, the parts that you don't, do whatever. There's also Puppet Enterprise. It's vendor supported from Puppet Labs, and it's a per managed node license model. The biggest difference between the two is Puppet Enterprise requires no assembly. It's like going to the store and picking up your Lego stuff already assembled. Puppet open source, you have to assemble it. And it's not quite as fun as Legos sometimes. And sometimes you're aiming for what's on the box and you get something totally different. So depending on your knowledge level and your interest and your team size, you can look at which one might work better for you.
Okay, so if I've committed to a particular flavor of Puppet, what does my architecture look like? I mean, I know from a little bit of reading that there's, you know, a main server, and then there's an agent, and then my knowledge quickly breaks down. So what does that Puppet architecture look like?
Yeah, so there's actually two modes you can run it in, and the mode you're talking about is with a master. You have one or more masters. They provide catalogs to the agents. And the masters can also manage themselves through Puppet so they can be their own agents. There's also a masterless mode, and each node compiles its own catalog and applies it to itself. So you have to have an agent, which means you have to have Puppet installed, but you don't have to have a master. And what the master or the agent or the local apply does is it takes the manifest that you create and it compiles a catalog, which is a graph of all the managed resources that you define for a node and the order they're applied in. For instance, you might say that I want this group and this user, and Puppet figures out, well, the group needs to be there for the user because the user belongs to the group. So you don't have to worry about some of those details, and it builds that and then applies it. In addition to the agent and the master components, there's a Puppet DB service, which is basically a database service. Whenever agents run, they can send a report to the Puppet DB, and it collects all the catalog details, what resources were applied, whether they were successful, and whether or not the overall run was successful. And then there's one other main component called Hira, or Hira. You'll hear it pronounced differently, H-I-E-R-A, so however you prefer. And it's just a key value pair lookup tool. So you say, I want the key for my NTP servers, and it responds with them. The trick here is that you can provide a hierarchy so that you can say, this data center gets these NTP servers, this other data center gets a different set of NTP servers.
It's like DNS for config values almost. I'm trying to draw an analogy there.
Yeah, and you can set up whatever hierarchy you want. You can have all the way down to this node based on its fully qualified domain name, or you can have it by data center. You can do tons of things there.
And that would prevent you from hard coding any specific, you know, values within the scripts. And it just pulls from a kind of like a value repository that can be dynamic with just pointing to it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's fancy.
You were talking about the different kinds of things that you can control within a catalog, and you talk about like NTP servers as an example and so on. I'm imagining if it's an operating system, there's a lot of that gut configuration kind of stuff that I could control. What about applications that are running on the server, like this is a web server of some sort? Can Puppet also drive like an Apache config?
Sure, yeah. A lot of the native resources are what you'd expect: files, users, groups, packages, services. For Apache, you would say, okay, I want the package, whatever it's called on your operating system. You want file for the httpd.conf, and you give it whatever inputs you want. You can use a template, like I mentioned before. You can use just a flat file. And then you say that I want the service to be started. It'll go out and do that. And you can also have it pull down, say, your website from a version control repository or from a package or mount an NFS point, whatever you need it to do.
It kind of reminds me of group policy, but way better. Not that anyone really loved group policy, but maybe if you're a Windows guy or an AD girl and you're thinking, huh, this maybe sounds like GPOs, I would agree with you in a sense. How do I build, I guess it would be like a library of tasks, or what would we call those, you know, automation pieces of code within Puppet?
The proper term would be manifest, but in each manifest, you're defining a number of resources. So if you want to automate something, you just have to think of it in what's called a declarative state model. And what that is, use Puppet DSL, which stands for domain-specific language, to say, I want a username Bob who has a password of test. And to kind of compare what the difference is between declarative model, which is probably new for a lot of people, versus the imperative model people use almost every day, the imperative model says, okay, check etc password and etc shadow, or if it's Active Directory, check Active Directory, see if there's a username Bob. Okay, there's no username Bob, I need to create one. Okay, if it does exist, let's check the password. It's not test, let's make it test. So that's an imperative model. You're iterating through a number of steps. A declarative model, you say what you want, not how you want it to get there. So you just say, I want Bob to exist, and Puppet figures out how to make that happen.
So you kind of extracted away the steps to make it so, and you're just saying, at the end of the day, I want this. You make it happen, your problem.
Exactly. That's the declarative state model. You're defining a state. You say, this is the state that I want. I want a Linux box that has a username Bob, and I want a Windows box that has IIS, and I want them both to use these NTP settings. And then Puppet gets it there. And a huge benefit to this as well is, if I go in and I delete Bob, Bob's going to get pretty mad. But Puppet, the next time it runs, sees that the state of the system as it is doesn't match the desired state, and it gets it there.
So yeah, well, if Bob needs a better password than test. I mean, that's
Bob
why
needs
we delete
a better
Bob's
password.
Account,
but
so.
If you're going in and you're tweaking files by hand that are being managed by Puppet, Puppet's going to reset them. kind of a blessing and a curse. If you're the kind of person who just goes and does things ad hoc on the system, personally, I think that that's kind of a bad idea, especially, you know, a lot of people do that at like 5 minutes to five, and then they come in the next morning and everything's broken. Puppet would prevent that. If you go and you make the change, you got to put it in the Puppet system so that Puppet's managing it, which gives you a little bit of structure and workflow surrounding it, as opposed to just somebody made a change to the file, we don't know what it is, and now we lost it, or we had something that worked and somebody changed it, we don't know how to get back there. Puppet just sets up whatever you want and maintains that.
Now, Rob, in a declarative model, you said Puppet just kind of figures it out. I want this to be the state, and then Puppet just sorts out how to do that, and the magic is abstracted away. But Puppet ain't reading man pages, so how does Puppet know what it is that needs to get done?
Well, it's the Puppet code itself for Puppet or the Puppet agent. It has code that will vary by operating system that says, for a user resource, here's how I do that. For a file resource, here's how I manage it. You don't have to worry about it. But like I said, if you wanted to get into one of those hackathons or something, you could take a look at some of that and maybe tweak some of it to perform better. You know, if you're, say, creating 1,000 files, that can be a tedious operation sometimes. So you can get into the guts of Puppet and see what's going on there. But for 90% of people, you don't need to worry about that, but you certainly can.
But it's right in the guts of the Puppet code, as opposed to being like a module for Program X that handles that abstraction for you, so you can just hand a declarative state to the module.
It's a lot like hiring a general contractor. You know, yeah. You just tell them what to do, and then they hire the specialists that do it, which would be the code on the node. Is that close?
Correct. And that's for the built-in types. For additional types, you can define your own in what are called modules from Puppet, and they use the term types and providers. So a provider might be RPM, where the type is a package. So you can go out and you can define your own. We can probably, off the top of our head, name 4 or 5 different providers for packages, like RPM, DEB, MSI. If you had some other weird format that you made up on your own, you could go out there and you could add a provider for the package type and put it in your module, and then you could use it, and then you could share that module and other people could use it. But like I said, for most people, that's either something they're not going to get to or something that's a little higher level, maybe when they've been using it for 6 months to a year.
Okay, so most of the built-in code and functionality should be good enough to start, or at least get me down to the 10-yard line before I start getting fun with some custom-built code.
Yeah, I've been using it for 2 years, and I've looked at some of the code for that, but I haven't had to write one.
Oh, yeah, well, that must be nice. You know, it's like, woo. I was thinking, Oh man, 3 months in, I start writing custom, you know, manifests and stuff. That doesn't sound fun. But let's talk a little bit about Puppet Forge. I know that it's a way that you can acquire other people's modules and code and also contribute yours.
So Puppet Forge is a central repository equivalent to something like CPAN or RPM Find or other tools like that. And you can go out, you can make your own module, you put in some information that defines the author and your version numbers and dependencies, and you upload that to the Forge. And there's something like 3,500 plus modules available on the Forge, so there's a lot out there. I would certainly recommend, before anybody go writing a module, go take a look and see if there's one out there that does it for you. And there's some great things here. You've got information that's out on the Forge, and I go out and there's probably 200 different modules for Apache, because some people do think they need their own, or maybe they really do, but you'll find a lot that are, you know, it's a great starter one for everybody, because everybody understands Apache to some extent, and you can start working on your first public module that way.
My wheel that I reinvented is shinier than your wheel.
Pretty much. So if you go out and you find that Puppet Labs makes an Apache module, but say the Puppet Labs one doesn't really work for you, you could take a look at that. Their module itself is hosted on GitHub. You could fork it, make some changes to it, and submit a pull request back to Puppet Labs so they could roll it up into their module. So that way, in a week or a month, however long it takes to get integrated, you could use the Puppet Labs Apache module with whatever tweak you needed to make it work for you. Or you could keep that fork, make it your own thing, and work on it that way. And
it's my precious.
Yeah. And there's a lot of reasons you might do that. You might really have some special case that doesn't make sense for other people. Or you might work for a company that doesn't trust stuff off the internet, which is, in my opinion, a good stance to take. and they might not want you to be pulling stuff directly from GitHub. So some people will either create their own branches, and that way it's kind of locked in time, or they'll have some sort of GitHub mirror that they use.
So Rob, would you say that Puppet could be a bad fit in certain circumstances? Just, you know, really not the operational environment that Puppet's going to work well in?
Yes and no. There's probably no reason that it can't work in an environment. But as I mentioned earlier, its real strength is that declarative model. Here's what I want. And one of the great strengths to that is, as I said, you don't need to care about what's underneath. So that code that says add user Bob works on Red Hat, on Debian, on Mac OS X, on AIX, which is great. But if you get away from that strength, if you try and force it to act as an imperative engine, I want to do X, and then I want to do Y, and then I want to do Z. You can make Puppet do it, but you know that old saying, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. That's kind of the situation you get yourself into. And there's probably some times where you have to do that. Many of us are supporting legacy software that really, you know, may need an interactive GUI for an install. There's no option for an answers file. And that's really hard to ram into a headless install mode. You've got to maybe install it somewhere and then copy files and then mangle the crap out of it to try and get it to work right. And if you're doing that, if that's like the one thing that you do with Puppet that's wrong, you're good. But if that's how you have to do everything, you're kind of backing yourself into a corner. And you can make it work, but every time you do an upgrade to Puppet, or you change your code a little bit, because you're not saying this is the state I want, you're saying I want you to do these 10 steps in a row, it becomes much more tedious, and it doesn't really work to Puppet's strength.
Now, we've been talking about using Puppet in the context of Unix variants. Would I use Puppet if I was a Windows shop?
Sure. We mentioned the PowerShell DSC being used by Puppet, so that's there. It manages MSI packages, and there's a lot of Forge modules now that support Windows. So it could be anything from just local users to more specific modules that manage IIS or some other common Windows application. I think there's one for SQL Server.
All right, so Rob, let's wrap up with a thought here. Let's say you have some things you want to manage with Puppet, and other things you just don't. You know, what does that scenario look like, and what do you do in that scenario?
In that scenario, you only manage the things you want. And that's another great thing about Puppet. It just manages the things that you tell it to. So if you've got a system that you want to get into Puppet, but you can't get it in today, or you don't think you're ever going to be able to get it into Puppet the right way because it's got some legacy application that won't work, or the owners won't let you touch it, you can still do things like have a base profile that manages the NTP or the syslog settings on the node. So you just manage that, the clunky Oracle application that's sitting on top of it, you don't touch it. So you can do the best of both worlds there. And you can use that as a way to ease into Puppet as well. You can add in the Puppet with the base functionality of kind of treating the OS, and then add in some of the application layers as you go.
So, Chris, we reflect back on Puppet architecture, on modules, and so on. I think the thing that stuck out to me the most was grasping imperative versus declarative. So as before, I was trying to grasp orchestration versus automation, and I think I got that. I think I now get imperative versus declarative, which comes up a lot. Even in my world of networking, is there's been discussions about network intent and how you describe that and so on. And the way Rob put it was imperative, iterating through a bunch of steps, do this, do this, do this, do this, versus declarative, which is, I want some state to occur, and you're defining the state that you want the box to be in, but not the do this, do this, do this steps that are going to make that state happen. Rather, you're saying, I want the state to occur, and you figure it out. So that difference between imperative and declarative, because that terminology comes up so much when reading about automation, it was very helpful to me to gather that context in a simple way now. What about you?
Automation, definitely. Just hearing the show so far, we need a crib sheet for all the different terms. Definitely a lot of learning. I almost need like a Webster's Dictionary as we're going through here. But I echo what you're saying, and I'm also thinking about the reasoning and the thought process behind picking your configuration management tool. I think there's a lot of kind of common sense points, you know, pick one that you kind of like, makes sense for your environment, you know, what language you might know. But I also kind of like the idea of picking one because you want to contribute back to the documentation or the code or building those granular units of work being modules. And so perhaps knowing the language just for that reason in and of itself is another, I guess, maybe lower priority, but good reason to pick one configuration management tool versus others. And I also love Puppin 8 reading man pages. I think that's quote of the day there, buddy.
You like that?
Oh, yeah. Let's get a little super nerdy and awesome here. Let's talk about process. So, Rob, I'm curious, what is it like to deploy either a host, a guest, an application, pick your poison, using Puppet?
So the first thing you need to do is figure out your state model. Here's what I want, and you need to find some way to describe it. When you do that, you put together your manifest, and you assign that class to a node. We'll say our node is profile some app. Some app contains a bunch of different things that you've defined as the state for this application. When the agent runs, the first thing is it's going to make sure that it's communicating via SSL. So you've got some security built into the agent to master communication. And you can run it as root if you're going to manage the whole system, but you can also run as non-root if you want to, say, let a user manage their .dot files or something. Obviously, it's restricted to what that user can do. When you start the agent, it runs, goes out to the master, gets the compiled catalog of all the different resources it needs to apply, pulls that down, and then starts applying them on the local node. And it's going to do that by default every 30 minutes. You can certainly adjust that time or use an orchestration engine to only kick it off when you want to, whatever suits your needs. And then when the agent runs, if you're doing this interactively, like if you sat down at the console and triggered it yourself, you'd see everything scroll on the screen showing you all the different resources it's applying, whether they're succeeding, whether they're failing. It includes any sort of error message there. If you're not sitting there interactively, it's going to log to syslog, and it's also going to go into the Puppet DB service. So you have some idea of what happened if things didn't go so well. And of course, it has useful exit codes. So if you're tying Puppet, a lot of people will tie Puppet into a provisioning system like vRealize Orchestrator or any sort of front end that would kick off Puppet on a node. And you can then take those exit codes and the failure messages and bring them back to the user or the system wherever is appropriate, so you know what's worked and what didn't.
What's the security model look like for Puppet? So I've kicked off all this. I've just done a lot of very intimate and personal stuff to that server and those processes. So how is that secured and authenticated on the front end?
So you've got the SSL gets your communication, but your data at rest, you have certificates between the agent and the master. So when an agent goes out the first time, the master says, "Who are you? Why would I let you get configuration from me?" You can do some things to auto-assign, either based on a rule, which, by the way, star is not a rule. Please don't just auto-assign every certificate.
Allow any.
It's technically possible, but don't do that. Or you can have something interactive. You know, if you're using VRO, you could have a workflow that goes out and signs the cert. And then once the cert is signed, when the agent checks in, it gets a config. Now, it's up to the user to figure out how the configs are generated and who has access to it and all that. So Puppet gets out of the way and lets you figure that part out. But once it's in Puppet, uses the certificates and the SSL to communicate and protect against somebody just throwing a node up on your system saying, "I'm SQL, give me all your SQL server passwords."
So yeah, it's both ends, isn't it? I hadn't really thought about that. It's on the one side, you don't want some random client coming up on the wire and saying, "Tell me all of your secrets." On the other, but I was really thinking about it from the other end. You don't want to be able to push a change down into a box that happens to be running a Puppet agent. I hadn't really thought about it being both ways that security and authentication are important. Interesting.
So you mentioned manually kicking off a process and watching it through the logs and all that kind of jazz. Is that just kind of a testing thing, or normally are all these processes just automatically firing off at that 30-minute interval?
For the most part, they're automatically firing off. But especially when you're starting new with a Puppet installation and you're defining the first state on your first system, you're going to sit there at the console, you're going to run Puppet, and you're going to look at all the errors it spits out, because first time doing anything, we always have some issues. So you're going to see what spits out, and then you're going to be able to go back and fix it. And you know, sometimes it's going to be in the Puppet code. Maybe you asked it to do some things out of order. or maybe it's because your system couldn't talk to something else where it was supposed to get a package off the network. But it's all up there for you to see. There's some other things you can do before you even push it out. And this kind of gets back to the DevOps thing, where it's a culture more than just tools. But before you even push your code to production, you can have two tools that are really cool. One is called RSpecPuppet. Ruby spec system is for unit tests. So RSpecPuppet is a Ruby spec system for Puppet unit tests. So as you're writing your manifest, that'll help you catch things like if you spelled the name of your package wrong. You have a test that says, I want package httpd to be installed. And then in your code, if you go and you say, I want package http and left off the d, it'll catch that. So that way you don't push that upstream. And then there's also another tool called Beaker RSpec, which is another Ruby spec system for acceptance tests. And in this case, what it does is it spins up a whole VM, applies all your code, and then checks what's on the state of the system after everything's run versus the state of the catalog. So if you went and you said install MySQL and add a database and pull it from a backup and make sure that the data is there, it would actually do that whole part. So you're not just testing that your code is written right, but that your system, your network connectivity, and all that works. So you get your end-to-end testing. And then, of course, once all that passes, then you go out and you do it for real. 9 times out of 10, everything should go fine. But if you need to, either on your first try of something, or if you see something isn't working in your dashboard that says this node's failing, you can just go run it normally and see what happens.
From some of what we've described here, you could get into some pretty complex configurations that you're deploying with Puppet. So what happens if your catalog deployment is only partially successful? Like a virtual machine gets stood up, but the app did not deploy successfully on it, some scenario like that.
Yeah, in that case, Puppet considers its work done because the last thing it'll do is tell you, hey, I ran and I had some errors. So it doesn't revert, it doesn't roll anything back, which I know is a feature sometimes people are looking for, but unfortunately is not available here. It leaves the system in whatever state that was, and you can either get in and try and fix it yourself or run Puppet again and see if it comes back. As I said, it could be network issues that prevent it from installing a package off the network.
Well, since it's state-driven, just running it again is not a problem, because if you say, I want the state to be right. X, if it already knows I've completed the first 8 steps, or it will detect, basically, the state is already here for these first 8 steps, so I'm going to continue on with the things that don't match the desired state.
Yeah, and Puppet is great for expanding your vocabulary. They use a term called idempotency, and what that means is if you do something twice, you get the same result. Yeah, the good example of that is, like we talked about, that user, that imperative model. You got to do all those checks to make sure something isn't in place before you run it again. Anybody who's written their own script knows you're always going to forget some edge case, and then you run something twice, and instead of getting what you had the first time, you have something different. And a lot of effort can be put into that, but something that's idempotent, like Puppet's application of a catalog, you run it twice. If there's nothing to do, there's nothing to do. If there's only one thing out of 1,000 things that actually is different from what the desired state is, it's just going to do that one thing.
Now, you just brought home the super importance of declarative versus imperative to me, because from a networking standpoint, historically, if you write a script, it's imperative. You're saying, create this interface, put it in this VLAN, you know, configure this spanning tree config, et cetera. And if you try to do the same thing again, that could get really ugly, just depending on the set of imperative commands you are, if there's no intelligence about state that are behind them, which typically there would not be in just a rote script. So you just really brought an important point home to me.
Yes. Doing that on some network devices in big networks could be very much a resume generating event.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Let's do a little silo busting here. It's always, I guess, my favorite part of the podcast. I can see, or at least mentally see, configuration management being probably one of the granddaddies of silo busting here, because I'm thinking, all right, if we're highly automated, if the environment is really using configuration management and orchestration, I can see or at least think of impacts for operations around bare metal provisioning, your hypervisors, storage, network security. What's your experience around busting those silos with configuration management? You know, let's talk about some challenges and some triumphs to get it kind of adopted in your environment.
There are definitely some challenges here, but almost all of them you can get around. You can't get around some of the political stuff, so we're going to ignore that. But we're going to assume that in your environment, you want to try and bust down some of these silos, at least get people working together and increase how much they're going across silos. So the bare metal side, I mentioned there's Razor, and that would run in your Puppet environment, but it's a different tool. So you kind of have a little bit of segregation there. But then once you get into, you know, the compute, storage, networking, and security side, it really is one big ball of wax. Now, Puppet only manages what you tell it to. So to ease into things, you can just say, okay, well, we're just going to assume that all the nodes that we manage have the right storage they need. And we're going to let the storage people do what the storage people do. And we're just going to manage the applications on them. And then as time goes on, you can add the storage stuff and you can add the networking, whatever you want to do there. It does cross those boundaries and it's up to you to figure out how to do it. Because it's all code-based, you should have all your code in a version control system. So it's going to rely somewhat on what you can do there. If you've got granular permissions, you might make parts of that repository only available to certain people, or certain people can view it but can't edit it. Or if that's not possible or not politically possible, you can always have multiple Puppet systems. Some people have different Puppet systems for different teams, or they have different repositories. So they might have 5 or 6 masters and different nodes check into different masters. You do lose some of the advantage of having just this single system where you can see everything. You don't get your single pane of glass, but it beats artisanal server support, which is really what you have when you're making everything on your own every day.
Let's use networking as an example, though. Let's say you're the, I guess, automation guru or someone that's writing the code. Is that how it works? Or is the networking folks writing the code to put in a Puppet? Are you working together? I'm just curious kind of where the ownership of defining the config overlaps with actually assigning it and building it within Puppet from a skill set and, you know, perhaps a silo perspective.
Yeah, the skill set side is sometimes tricky because, like I mentioned, you don't need to know Ruby, but the Puppet DSL kind of looks a little like Ruby. So everybody's got to have some introduction to it at least, but it's simple enough that most people can pick up. It takes a little bit of time, but not a whole lot. You know, a week or two of actually working with it, most people should be comfortable. As far as who's doing like IP assignments and stuff, you know, Puppet's part of the provisioning system. It really depends on how Puppet is involved there. For my uses, I'm doing IP assignment through vCenter. When I deploy a VM, I use a customization specification and I put an IP in there and I'm pretty much done. In other instances, I might need to manage routes, and routes are something that Puppet can definitely do because everything in the same data center or everything in the same VLAN might need the same routes. So you can put that in the Puppet code and only apply it to nodes that are in a certain VLAN. And then the networking people could maintain that one file that has all the route information.
One quick question for you, Rob, just to conclude this whole discussion about operations using Puppet. Is it a pain in the rear end to upgrade it? Because I'm thinking there's agents on stuff, and then if you upgrade the server, is the agent out of spec and then doesn't work anymore? How hard is that?
It follows semantic versioning, which means you got like your A.B.C. version. So as long as you're not going from two different A versions, like 2.x to 4.x, you know, that would be a pretty big hairy upgrade. But if you're going from like 3.7.0 to 3.7.1, it's real simple. And in most cases, all you do is you upgrade the master first, because the master has to be a higher level than the agents, and then you upgrade the agents. Make sure that you do it often enough that you're not doing those gigantic upgrades and it's easy. And you've got those things like RSpec Puppet to help you make sure that if you are crossing a border of a major minor version, that your code itself is still intact, or at least that you know it's not and have the time to go fix it before you upgrade everything.
All right, Rob, that doesn't sound like too painful of a Puppet upgrade then. Yeah, if I do the server first and then the agents, that works for me. And like you said, you don't really want to let things get too far behind anyway in real life. So, okay, how can I find out more about Puppet and give it a test drive? Where would I go?
Go to learn.puppetlabs.com. That's Puppet Labs' own website. They've got a huge repository of information and tips and tricks, and they've got something called a learning VM. It's basically a VM that has Puppet installed for you, plus this pretty cool Quest system that they created. And it's really neat. It gamifies learning Puppet. So you get points, and you've got to go through, and it tells you to do things, and it tells you how many of your tasks you've completed. So that's a lot more fun than just reading a book. I highly recommend that for anybody.
That VM will work on VirtualBox and maybe like VMware kind of stuff?
Yeah, and they have instructions for both, for VirtualBox and for VMware, and I think one or two other hypervisors.
I've used it. It was kind of a lot of fun. It was like, it reminded me of the old Zork or Return to Zork video game. You know, it's all text-based.
And it's great. They update it all the time. So if you learned Puppet 6 months ago and haven't used it, you can pick that up and in an hour or two kind of catch up.
Anywhere else you'd recommend?
Yeah. So I have a project called Puppet in a Box out on GitHub, just github.com/puppetinabox. And I kind of tried to do a little bit more than learning VM gets you, but not quite as fun with the Quest stuff. But it's basically a proof of concept lab. And it contains all the node definitions you need to stand up DNS and DHCP and the basic infrastructure to get a lab off the ground, and has some instructions on how to customize it and deploy it. And it highlights some of those best practice patterns too.
Rob, thanks a lot for coming on the show today, for sharing your wisdom and knowledge about Puppet and automation. How can folks follow you on the internet?
So you can find me as rnelson0 on Twitter and GitHub, and probably a lot of other places, but my blog is rnelson0.com. And I'm also going to be speaking at PuppetConf in October. So if you're headed to PuppetConf, please attend my session, Puppetizing Your Organization, on Friday, or watch the recap when it's available.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to today's show of the Data Nuts podcast. You can reach Ethan. He's at EC Banks on the Twitterverse. Or his blog. It's quite good. I read it. It's called ethancbanks.com. Go there. And I'm Chris. I'm at Chris Wall on the Twitterverse. You can go to my blog, not as good as Ethan's. It's wallnetwork.com. For more superb DataNauts content, do the crab walk. Head on over to packetpushers.net to partake on the bountiful feast of podcast goodness. Until then, may your server lights blink, your storage spindle spin, and your configuration management be configuration managed. I like that outro.
That was fun. I hope did you enjoy that?